This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the free streaming link. It's 3:01 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren.
Hello, how are you doing?
And hello once again, this is Ren Tawil, hosting your Monday afternoon edition of Mideast Madness on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's 3:03 p.m. on Monday, February 3, in the year of the Common Era, 2014. If that jives with your personal time-space continuum, then you know that the show is live, and you will have an opportunity to call in later. I'm beginning the show with a guest who is an artist. What kind of artist are you, Sarah?
Mixed media artist.
That sounds about what I would have said. Mixed media artist. And Sarah Friedlander is here in the studio. She is a longtime resident of Santa Cruz, though not from here originally. Not that that means anything important, but the thing is, Ms. Friedlander has put together an exhibit she calls Stonewalled in Jerusalem. I'm going to go ahead and read you her statement, statement slash description of the work and where she was coming from and putting it together. Sarah Friedlander says, "I was born into a secular Jewish family in America in 1950, and I remained the only family member who had never visited the Holy Land until June 2012. When conditions aligned themselves for me to travel there. Although I respect those with faith, I personally adhere to no formal religious practice and am fearful of religious fundamentalism's potential effects on the fate of the world. And yet, I readily identify myself as Jewish and take pride in my heritage. At the same time, because of my progressive political perspective, the Palestinians' plight, though far from blameless, has made it impossible for me to support Israel's policies of building separation walls and settlements in the occupied territories. Criticism of these matters has been discouraged in the United States, especially among Jews who shy away from discussing Israeli oppression for fear of being labeled self-loathing or anti-Semitic. I spoke freely about the conflict only in closed circles, and although well-traveled, stayed clear of Israel until this trip. However, once inside the old city of Jerusalem, with camera in hand, I was mesmerized and spent days walking the back alleys, tunnels, and stairways, where endless stone walls seemed to hold centuries of turmoil, as well as religious fervor. Although I'd heard Jerusalem repeatedly described as holy, spiritual, and sacred, for me, raw, unresolved conflict was evident on every surface and in every face. When I touched the Western Wall for the first time, unexpectedly, waves of emotion flooded me. The grief, the ghosts, the memories, the trauma, and deep scars held within these walls were palpable. The word irreconcilable permeated these passageways, and I felt the need to question why so many were rushing to the mosques, churches, and synagogues to pray. Are their prayers being answered? What are they praying for? Exactly what have monotheism's three major religions accomplished in the way of finding real peace in this area? Why, when empathy could heal so much, do insularity, survival, blame, and defensiveness abound? After returning from my first trip to Israel in 2011, I searched for an artistic way to express my impressions to those who have not yet been to Jerusalem, those who remember well their own experience there, and those who, like myself, have kept silent about our conflicted feelings concerning the situation there. I researched and then edited thousands of original and archival photographs, and this led to the concept of creating a stone wall with each, quote, narrative stone carved from wood panels and then painted and embedded the digitally collaged images of present-day cohabitants of the old city, all crossing paths with one another while commingling with the ghosts that continue to haunt and separate them. At the Wailing Wall, visitors routinely leave a prayer in the crevices between stones. These are intended to honor the departed or to express personal hopes for the future. I'm asking the viewers of this wall to interact with it by offering ideas, constructive comments, and reactions or prayers for traversing this seemingly hopeless situation, ways to open dialogue and help leaders and world citizens alike contemplate engaging in discourse and perhaps, like South Africa, approach this impasse from outside the box. And, of course, if any of you felt a little confusion in my description there, as I did it's at certain sentences, this last paragraph is talking about Sarah's artistic rendition of the wall using the medium of the wood this and paper and other materials in her exhibit, which is entitled
Stonewalled in Jerusalem. And I'd be happy to describe how I went about creating it and what it looks like to clear up any of that confusion. My husband's a cabinet maker, and he makes frames that are panels, and they're rectangular in shape, and I carve them into stones that resemble the stones in Jerusalem, which are very distinctive the way that they're laid on top of each other. And then I embed, basically glue, a collaged print that has come from my own images and archival images. The archival images are in black and white. My images are in color. And they're digitally collaged, you know. So I do that in Photoshop, and then I paint the entire stone to look congruent with its colors and textures and put them together into a wall. And between the crevices of that wall, I provide papers for people to leave messages the way they do at the Wailing Wall. And that way they, too, can contribute to the dialogue.
I have seen this the exhibit at Sarah Friedlander's personal studio, and here in Santa Cruz, where Sarah's lived for since 1973, and I will say that I was, among other things, taken, struck by the artistic luminescent beauty of many of the blocks. I remember commenting to Sarah at the time that I was very impressed by the deep three-dimensional quality of many of the panels. About half of them are images of one walking through the old city in the old sectors of Jerusalem and looking down a hallway or through an archway under under an overpass. There was I was struck by the great beauty of the depth, just at least from a aesthetic point of view. And as I told Sarah at the time, I'm by no means an expert on these matters, but just as a piece of artistic endeavor, it's very beautiful. But it is indeed a collage. It's wall-mounted. What are the dimensions?
It's about 11 feet long by 4 feet tall.
Uh-huh. And, and again, just as visitors, if one has not been to Jerusalem, most likely many of you have seen pictures of Hasidic Jews and other individuals who are praying at the wall, and they may have a book, a scripture that they're reading from while they're praying or looking at while they're praying, and they will take, they will write something, obviously kept between themselves and the wall, on a small piece of paper, folded, and put it into the crevice of the wall. And I was struck by Sarah's clever adaptation of that situation by allowing visitors to her exhibit to write their messages, which are written written on the white paper, but there is it's carbon, is it not?
It is actually, there's a carbon copy, so the people can leave that message behind for me to put together into a collection, possibly into the future. There are hundreds of pieces of paper in the wall already, and hopefully as it gets out into the world, there'll be many more. And it empowers people to feel like they can have something to add to this discussion. I also want to just say that I had never seen Jerusalem before, and I had heard stories for years, and when I got there, it was these alleyways and this incredible maze of walkways and passages that people were rushing by each other. I mean, very many of them were on their way to pray, but there were obviously plenty of tourists there as well. I tried to avoid those photographs and really tried to capture the people who live in the old city or who work in the old city, and just show how much they're kind of coexisting, and yet they're not really working with each other. It didn't seem that way. And yet the history seemed to envelop them. I mean, it seemed to be screaming out of the walls, the long history of conquest and you know, religious differences.
So, Sarah, when you visited Jerusalem, you were witness to the ancientness of the inanimate objects, if that's a fair use of the word, the presence of inanimate stone and all of these old artifacts that were traversed about by living peoples who were, I take it, obviously of different ethnicities or at least different spiritual traditions, mm-hmm. scattering about. What I wanted to say about the about Sarah's clever use of the visitor to the art piece, to the presentation, opportunity for them to write their messages on paper. It is made obvious to them that that a copy is automatically being made.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely.
And so,
and they can make a choice as to whether or not to leave that with me.
So we're not fooling anyone, or Sarah's not fooling anyone. Their words are being recorded. When looking and preparing for this, I was looking at the images online here, and when I first began looking at the artwork in her studio, I did notice a certain surrealistic quality. But then online, when I looked at the images again, this time I noted that almost every one, and you often have to hunt for this, has the archival images that Sarah was speaking about, sometimes tucked away in one corner of each given image. And they included things like black and white images of children playing or dancing. There was, I noticed one of the images on one of these wood carvings made to look like the ancient stone of Jerusalem. There was the black and white image of what were obviously Holocaust victims, still alive, but quite malnourished and very drawn of face, very thin, lying and sitting in bunks, and they were sort of tucked off to the side, while right next to it was someone ostensibly in the present time doing what they were doing, stooping over to pick something up or walking by.
Three little girls in that particular one were just walking down the street, and three little girls that you couldn't tell whether they were Jewish Israelis or Arab Israelis. You just had no way of knowing that. And yet, I wanted to, you know, just bring out that there was so much suffering that brought people there or that expelled people from there. And that by not being able to talk about both histories and not being able to really grieve together so much of the tragedy that's been happening there over the last 60 years, that people don't actually get to heal. And so they are just kind of muted. And I felt as though Americans were particularly discouraged from talking about it. And as a Jewish American who, you know, has, you know, been kind of captivated by that repressive sensibility, that if you talk about it, you're kind of going against Israel or against your people. I really wanted the audience to be aware of their own inhibitions. And I got, when I showed it at Open Studios, I got one comment after the next of appreciation for allowing people to think about it and talk about it more openly. And that's why I really felt like it should be out there in the public, if that was at all possible.
Including from many Jewish people, or as far as you could tell?
Many Jewish people. And I gave a couple of talks when the piece was at the Art League in a political art show. And there were many non-Jewish people who were coming and saying, you know, we don't know how to talk about this. You know, we're seeing that obviously the Israelis needed, you know, especially when they were leaving Europe, they needed a homeland. We also understand that the Palestinians were having to leave their homeland. How does that work? You know, how can we talk about this in a compassionate way?
So it's true then that you personally were just by being there and by seeing and by bearing witness to the differences in lifestyles within the old city and the differences in the way that people look, you were genuinely struck both emotionally and in other ways by these differences?
Yeah, I actually, you know, because so many people go there and everybody is oohing and aahing about how gorgeous it is and how beautiful and precious everything is about it, I just got waves of sadness. It seemed like such a sad place to me. And, you know, it wasn't as though I was in a vacuum. I mean, I've been watching films. When I come back and I was trying to figure out how I was going to express my initial reactions, I really did a lot of reading, and I watched some really positive Israeli films, positive in the sense that it was incredibly positive that all this information is coming out right now. And I actually wanted, I brought a list of a couple of things that I really thought listeners could look into, because they're available now, widely available, and they tell a story that hadn't been told before. And so I'm going to just tell them about a couple of films.
Please,
The Gatekeepers, The Law in These Parts, Five Broken Cameras, Kadosh, Fill the Void. There's a new film by someone who's living locally named Jessica Hobby called Mars at Sunrise. And all these films really show the history in a way that I hadn't been aware of it. And they've come out in the last year and a half.
And right away when Sarah began reading these, my ears perked up right away with the first one she mentioned. The Gatekeepers, of course, came out, I believe, last year. And I believe that is the film featuring retired surviving members of the Israeli Secret Service, Shin Bet.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen that film, but it's interesting. On the one hand, the film is said to be very revealing of the emotional side of the Israelis who were involved with the security of the newfound state of Israel, and the film apparently has to do in part with their personal justification for their doing what they did. Interestingly enough, though,
their regrets as well,
and the regrets as well. I'm privy to some mixed reactions to the film. Miko Peled, who is a man both Sarah and I are acquainted with, or at least is what he does. Miko Peled is the son of an Israeli general, Israeli Defense Forces general, who was a hero in the 1967 war, which allowed Israel to acquire the rest of historic Palestine by conquest, as well as, all of Egypt, Sinai Peninsula, and a bit of Syria. Miko's father, Mati Peled, during that war was an officer, a hero, and he turned to pacifism. He became enlightened, as it were, and his son Miko followed in his footsteps. And Miko now lives in Southern California and tours, does lectures, and wrote his own book. Both of course, his father Mati's passed away now, but Miko is very much in solidarity with the Palestinian narrative. And Miko's, I read a short paragraph of Miko's reaction to the Gatekeepers. He literally said it made him sick.
Mm.
I think he was reacting to a certain superficiality of these old men who were former Shin Bet officers who perhaps were taking advantage of the film to relieve themselves of guilt, that kind of thing. So, but again, I haven't seen the film. Five Broken Cameras, of course, came out last year. It was nominated but did not win the Academy Award Oscar for Best Foreign Film. Five Broken Cameras presented and directed by one man who went through five cameras which were deliberately demolished and broken by Israeli security forces while he tried to film what those forces were doing to the people in his village in the West Bank. The Law in These Parts was presented on PBS, Channel 9 here in, well, PBS, broadcast television, last year as well. And I started looking at the comments that internet viewers were making on the film, and I have since formed something of a pen pal relationship with one gentleman who was just wildly responding to everything he didn't agree with amongst the other writers, and we have really gotten into it, but we have something of a camaraderie now. And you mentioned one or two that I've also seen through Netflix. You can get a number of these films on Netflix. I personally would like to add Salt of This Earth. You might want to write down Salt of This Earth. Fascinating, not a documentary, but a dramatization of a woman, Palestinian woman from Brooklyn, born and raised in Brooklyn, who is trying to visit her homeland and the various obstacles that she has to go through in order to get through the gates at the airport, through customs and all that, and how she deals with what she comes up with. So, yeah, Sarah, what would you like to see happen with this piece of work that you've created? And where would you like to go? I mean, where in terms of what venues and how realistic do you see the expansion of the viewing of this piece?
Well, I have been trying for the last year to get it out there in public. And as an artist, you don't exactly go to a museum and ask the museum if they would consider your piece. So that you need to actually have people recommend that kind of thing. And I did a lot of research to see if there was anyone who knew anyone who knew anyone who was either on the board of the Tolerance Center in Los Angeles, which I think would be the greatest place for it to be.
Sounds like you have to go through a lot of back doors in order to get your work shown.
You do, and there hasn't been a great reception when I've just simply written to the Skirball Center or to the Jewish Museums. Many times I don't hear anything back at all, or I hear that the work is too controversial and that the board of directors wouldn't approve. And I understand that the fear of losing, you know, their financial support, but I really think that right now is such a critical moment in terms of, I mean, especially because these peace talks, you know, have, you know, kind of given us a six-month window where something might happen, although it looks, you know, very doubtful, but something could possibly happen. It seems that Americans, especially American Jews, could say, let's, like, really get serious about our support for Israel or our lack of support for Israeli policy. And the only way that could ever happen is if people start talking about it in this country. If people aren't talking about it, nothing is going to happen.
And so on the one hand, Sarah Friedlander, you have had the experience of people reacting mostly very positively to your work and beginning to ask questions after they've been exposed to it. But on the other hand, experiencing the heartache of not being able to get your foot in the door through important venues where you think it really would get the exposure that it deserves and can contribute to, even as a work of art, and I don't want to be insulting by saying even as, but as something from the artwork as it might affect political realities, not seeing that embraced by the decision makers.
Well, I actually do have something good to report on that note since we last spoke to each other, because I actually have an opportunity now to show this work at the Jewish Community Center in Palo Alto for 3 months this summer, and I'm really excited that I did get my foot in the door that way. I had some friends who had some friends, and that was a great opportunity, and they were willing to show it, and I think that once people start seeing it, because it's incredibly balanced, there's nothing about it that isn't, from a humanitarian perspective, really compassionate. And that way in to talk about it from a human perspective as opposed to a political or a territorial perspective, I think, is the way that could possibly work the best. And so we'll see what happens when it's, in Palo Alto, and I'm really looking forward, to having some talks there, giving some opportunity for this kind of discussion to happen there, and we'll see where it can go from there.
Let me ask you, Sarah, before you went to Jerusalem some 3 years ago, did you have political inclinations, or did you consider yourself to be a regardless of your status as an artist, a person of perhaps stronger political inclinations in any areas?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see myself as a leftist political thinker, from the time I was fighting the Vietnam War when I was 15 years old.
Yeah, those are the days, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah and I are about the same age. I consider myself a child of the 60s, although I often felt perhaps a year or two younger than the set that was really dealing with stuff. Okay. What is there any outlook for making this presentation, say, out of state or relatively longer distances away?
Yeah, actually, people tell me that in Europe, that people are so much more likely to want to talk about this situation. And in the Middle East, certainly people would be and are much more comfortable talking about the situation there. In Israel, people talk about it all the time. It's mostly that I wanted it to be in America because Americans don't talk about it easily.
When you say in the Middle East, are you including Arabic countries?
That was what I was saying. I actually spoke to somebody who will be opening a museum in Lebanon, in Beirut, and he was saying that it would be thrilling to have that piece there and have, the ability for people there to even know that there are Jewish people who are really concerned about there being peace in Israel and Israel being safe and secure, and Palestinians having a homeland.
Or the fact that they do, in fact, have a homeland because they've been there for
live
millennium
as a nation.
As a sovereign, secure, free people with deserving as such every bit as much as Jews and other Israelis deserve security and sovereignty.
Absolutely.
There. Part of where I'm coming from. And I was talking to you to some extent about this. Having lived in Minneapolis in the fabled Twin City area of Minnesota for 35 years myself, and coming to know Minneapolis as a very arts-oriented municipality. It's a cosmopolitan area itself with a great many venues for art. What can I do? Who can I contact? Or how can I? What do I tell my friends exactly about this exhibit?
You know, actually, if anybody in the listening audience has any connection to any venue, whether it be a museum, a gallery, a Jewish community center, a peace center, a Middle Eastern study center, an organization that works for Middle East peace that has a lobby, it could travel. It's not so cumbersome that it can't be shipped and shown relatively easily. And it can be seen on my website, which is sarahfriedlander.com. And if you look on the website, you can find it. It's called, I mean, it's either stonewalled or wall, and it can be easily seen. Anybody locally can get in touch with me at sarahfriedlanderart.com, or at gmail.com, rather. And they can arrange to see it if they so choose. I'd be happy to show it to people.
Okay, please give us that particular website again.
Okay, it's www.sarahfriedlander.com. It's to see the visual representation of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the site that I have here on my screen, but you said Sarah Friedlander Art.
So my email address is sarahfriedlanderart@gmail.com.
And of course, Sarah is S-A-R-A.
Exactly, sorry.
No H. Friedlander is spelled F-R-I-E-D, Lander, L-A-N-D-E-R, sarahfriedlander.com/wall.
Mm-hmm.
And again, although the work itself is, as she explained to us, is some 11 feet by 4 feet wide. And that's the way it looks when it's wall-mounted, but of course it comes down in pieces, correct? Just
exactly.
Kind of like moving the entire Hearst Castle from one location to another, brick by brick. So it's not as though you need a long 11 or 12-foot a truck with an 11 or 12 foot trailer in order to put the thing in. It is dismantleable and it's very travelable, my opinion.
There are 22 stones and they're lightweight because they're made out of this multiple density fiberboard.
Okay, if I can adopt a little bit of the old devil's advocate here. For a moment, as I mentioned toward the beginning of the interview, I was very awestruck by the beauty of the mixed media. Mostly, what appear to be mostly photographs or elements from photographs mixed in with the somewhat bizarre and surreal images that, to me, represent the ghosts of things that are in people's minds, that are kind of bounce off the walls of the old city of Jerusalem, the scenes from the Holocaust, children dancing, and other such things.
Those children, by the way, are orphans, French orphans from the Holocaust, German kids who were transported in that particular image, and they're juxtaposed with a sweet child in Jerusalem who is playing in, you know, a corner.
When you say the children were transferred, you mean to Palestine?
No, those particular children, that was an archival image of children who were transported from Germany, Jewish children who were transported from Germany to a French school, and they were playing and being taken care of during that time. There are lots and lots of images of the Palestinian exile from Jerusalem in that wall as well. And
yes, I remember a procession of a family in black and white, a fairly famous, perhaps stock photo of Palestinian refugees who were expelled or effectively expelled from their homes upon the creation of the State of Israel in May of 1948. Mm-hmm. And how ironic to think that the children, some of those children, as they were when those old photographs were taken, those who survived that situation may very well have ended up in Israel and Palestine themselves, mm-hmm. to become Israeli residents and citizens. Speaking technically about the work, I'm sure it was it could be really difficult when you're doing mixed media, so as not as to make it have the desired effect or the potential effect on the viewers as possible, but at the same time not to make it look well. It's just that some of the images struck me as kind of almost silly, or had a certain.
Well, there was a character. Quality. I mean, I think the character that I captured actually on film of a young man dressed like Jesus walking through the streets of the old city in 2011. You know, with a kind of pot belly. I mean, I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about. The children who were playing were children, you know, of the Holocaust. So that was, I mean, I didn't put it in there. I put it in there because, just as you said, those children may be the 80-year-old, you know, immigrants whose lives were really broken when they got there. You know, I've thought about this often. I've thought that the people who were coming there from the Holocaust were not whole people. They were really devastated, and they were arriving. Maybe they were going into a house where a Palestinian had been exiled, and they probably didn't have what it would have taken to have compassion at that moment. And it's so painful to think that then a whole nother generation was devastated in the same way, and everyone was, you know, psychologically traumatized to such an extent that they haven't figured out how to get past that. And it's, you know, I mean, that's what was so dramatic. And I'll have a disclaimer here. I was a marriage and family therapist for 30 years before I started being an artist. And so in some ways, because I know about broken families and broken hearts, that was what I was picking up on. And that was what I tried to put into this wall, was that there was a lot of really serious trauma going on. And that you're getting people trying to work through things without a lot of help. I mean, there are actually now organizations that are operating in Israel, Palestine, dealing with these issues, but it has taken a long time for that to become the you know, the foreground discussion.
I remember you commenting about these things at our first meeting. And how struck you were, as you pretty much just said, by, I believe you put it along the lines of Jewish people who have survived the Holocaust or otherwise were connected to it, who became Israelis, who continue to carry that trauma with them to the point where they can't seem to see past it and perhaps extend whatever degree of compassion they're still capable of to the native Palestinian Arabs. And do I have that right? Is that?
Well, it's kind of, I mean, I was imagining what it would be like to come where everybody, you know, in your village had been killed, where you'd watched, you'd come out of the camps, and then you go to a place where you think you've been liberated, not necessarily from a religious perspective, thinking that this is your, you know, like
Holy Land,
or this is the place, but actually being psychologically damaged, traumatically damaged, and not having the wherewithal to heal from that, and then not necessarily having that those issues addressed directly. Most people didn't talk about it, didn't want to lay that on their children. They just held it in. But we know what repression of, you know, anger and rage and fear and trauma does to people. And then having yet a whole nother people's having, you know, had that experience and not wanting to empathize and own up. But yeah, I mean, truly the incapacity, you know, because of that kind of broken core.
Well, okay, you as a person who has geographically been to that place, and having witnessed it, and I as someone who has never been to Israel, but I did have the good fortune to visit the Gaza Strip in 2008. I was there for about a week. That is the limit of my touring of the Middle East so far. That and the island of Cyprus, which is not exactly Middle Eastern, but I would, for myself, I would take it a step further and suggest that the bitterness and psychological in this base of psychological damage that they and their parents and grandparents experienced from the Holocaust and World War II seemed in so many cases to feel free to continue to vilify and demonize the native Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs, for what they consider to be the sake of Israel, for the security and the well-being of Israel. Police, IDF forces, military, even the judges and Supreme Courts, by various things that I've come across and read, almost seem to have this certain duty-bound fixation on what they're doing as permitted, given what happened to the Jewish people.
See, I would think that it would come from the terror that it was going to happen again, and the belief that the people hate them so much for what they've done, but I don't think that they can go to for what they've done. I don't think that they can hold that long enough to say, I can look at what America does in other parts of the world and understand, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like, so getting back to that question, I think that in Israel there's such a fear that it would happen to them again, and that in fact that it is, they've just transferred their fear to that the Palestinians would want them killed, and it's not as though many of them wouldn't, for what we would imagine is for good reason. On the other hand, there is no good reason. This is what the problem is that people cannot figure out how to live together, as opposed to that that everybody should be living alone and have their enemies, you know, in proper place.
Sarah, do you believe in a two-state solution as such?
I really believe in a two-state solution, but when you say as such, I don't know what the as such is going to look like. So I definitely believe in a two-state solution.
Well, there have been and are on the table, whether anyone's looking at them right now or not, a short list of possibilities. A two-state solution based, of course, most broadly on pre-1967 boundaries of Israel, which came into being in early 1949, being the Jewish state and the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, which before 1967 was not occupied by Israel. It was occupied by the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Those three areas, West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, comprising an independent and sovereign Palestinian state, hopefully a democratic and secular one as well, which incidentally I do not see Israel as being truly either democratic or truly secular, as seems to be the popular belief. And of course, John Kerry and others will tell you that based on those physical boundaries, negotiations would have to be made to finalize actual boundaries and things like that to
land swap
two states. And then there is something called the binational single state solution, and I'm not at all sure how that would work. I myself am a one-stater. I see no future whatsoever for an independent and truly viable Palestinian state. The current Israeli far-right government has done everything it can to sabotage the possibility of that coming into being. I look forward to a single state, call it Palestine, Israel, Canaan, the Levantine, whatever you want to call it. I don't care what it's called, but everyone there does have to be living on equal footing in terms of equality, political leanings, and the other important measures. Heartbreakingly, I have come across so many Jewish people who, including this newfound pen pal friend of mine, who adhere, like, as I put it to them, you would hear like taffy, and I'm trying to pull this taffy off of you, to words like, and phrases like, the destruction of Israel. If you want a single secular and a truly democratic state, you're going to destroy the Jewish character, which, by the way, I see it as largely artificial anyway, because it was reinstituted after about 2,500 years in the 20th century. This is the Jewish character that you see is so critical to the identity of Israel, but they always fly back to that use of that term. You're going to destroy Israel if you make that kind of a single secular state. And of course, they use the word destroy because it's so powerful. And again, I think it's reflective of the ongoing trauma that Holocaust survivors carry with them into Israel. We just can't have that, regardless of what happens to the Palestinians.
Right. So I don't think actually either of these two options are exactly what are going to happen, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I can't imagine the Jews of the world actually allowing, as you say, because I think they're so totally panicked. I mean, we're not just talking about the Holocaust on some level. For Jews, it's been an entire history of
pogroms in Russia, persecution in Europe,
forever. And I'm not going to take that position at all to argue with you, because I don't have that feeling that we need a religious Jewish state. I'm not a religious person, so I would more than likely say I would love the idea of this, you know, one, but it won't happen. I mean, because the Jews that are there would be terrified that the population would be dominated by the Hasidic Jews and the Arabs. I mean, and there would be no secular Jewish, you know, population left. The secular Jews right now, especially the leftist Jews, are leaving Israel because it's so painful for them right this second that they don't have enough power and enough ways of expressing themselves. And the religious, especially the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, are a terrifying phenomenon for me and for most secular Israelis, never mind for the future of one or two state solutions. So I think it's all, I mean, I think if they can come up with any solution whatsoever that allows for any agreement, they're going to be lucky.
I'd also like to throw in the fact that there are, at least in a few key examples, among those leftist or seemingly leftist Israelis who have chosen to leave Israel, some of them pretty much had no choice, such as the case with author Ilan Pape and perhaps Miko Pellet themselves, who became ostracized because they dared to speak about these things and they dared to address the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. Pape and his family essentially fled, became refugees from the land of the refugees into the United Kingdom. And of course, Pellet and his family live in San Diego.
This is a sad situation, I mean, all around. It's really tragic. And the whole world is affected by it, which is, I think, the reason, one of the other reasons why I think it's so important for people to begin talking about it more freely. Mostly you just kind of get, oh, let's not talk about it. It's just too difficult or it's hopeless. But I think nothing will happen if people don't talk about it.
And this was all said, well, it's been repeated through the past 60-odd years from a number of quarters, and even going back as far as immediately after the creation of the modern state of Israel in 48 and 49, Arnold Toynbee, a British scholar, and I believe he might have also been a civil servant, in one capacity or another, made the comment, not repeating verbatim, but he essentially, this was in 1949, Toynbee said to the effect of, how shameful, how ironic it is for those who have suffered the pains that the Jewish people have of them to perpetrate these same pains upon the natives of a new land. What Sarah is talking about is the reflection of an observation that has been made time and time again. And of course, it has been largely lost to history because of the success of the Jewish state, which, shucks, that's really a whole other story. People who have listened to my program will tell you they've heard it all from me before. Mm-hmm. But Sarah, you've been with, we're going on close to an hour now. Have we covered pretty much everything that you think you'd like to talk about?
I'm fine with leaving it at this point, because it would be great for me if people wanted to see the piece, they could contact me, and if people want to talk to me about it anymore, that would be terrific.
Private showings are available here in Santa Cruz.
Absolutely.
Then again, go to sarahfriedlander.com for the contact information. Your email address is
sarahfriedlanderart@gmail.com.
sarahfriedlanderart@gmail.com. Okay, then. I wish you the greatest success in everything that you do, and given the commonality of our convictions, great success with this particular exhibit, Stonewalled in Jerusalem. Again, with the devil's advocate thing, do you have any second thoughts about calling it Stonewalled in Jerusalem? I mean, isn't that kind of... is there anything else you could have come up with to entitle this?
I'm sure there is, and I'm not wedded to it, but it just felt like everybody's being stonewalled, and it just was a painful reality, and so stonewalled it is.
I guess you're right.
Thank you,
Sarah Friedlander. And we'll have a musical break, and then we'll get on with the rest of Mideast Migraines for this February 3, 2014 episode. If I can find the right slider here.
Thank you. Come on, Keith.
You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 on the FM dial, and we are streaming as an online radio service as ever, www.freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Click on the red oval. Remember to do that the next time, if you're listening to us over the airwaves now, and if you want to listen on your little computers, go to freakradio.org's main page, scroll down, and click on the red oval that you see there. That'll give you the free streaming link to our service. It is 4:09 Pacific Standard Time here on the west coast of North America. My name is Ren, and you are indeed listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, the first half of which was taken up with an interview by one Sarah Friedlander, very nice person who has been a multimedia artist for a long time now. And she talked about her presentation, presentation is not always the best word to use when you're talking about mounted artwork. Her piece of work, her piece of art, entitled Stonewalled in Jerusalem. More information about that, including how to get in touch with Sarah for a private showing or group showing of her work here in Santa Cruz. That is at sarahfriedlander.com/wall, S-A-R-A, Friedlander, F-R-I-E-D-L-A-N-D-E-R, all one word, sarahfriedlander.com/wall. Okay, we'll tuck that one away. Who knows when the next live interview will be, but yes, Sarah was here in the studio with us. Now, I've talked a bit about the latest sort of Hollywood-oriented scandal about actress Scarlett Johansson, or Scarlett Johansson, which arose when it became known that in addition to her position as ambassador, to whom exactly I forget, but Scarlett Johansson was enjoying her position as ambassador to the world at large, or to popular culture, for Oxfam. Oxfam, O-X-F-A-M, is actually a charitable or humanitarian organization dedicated to helping feed the hungry of the world. It has a reputation going back many decades. I believe I actually had something to do with them many decades ago, a little bit. And those details escape me. But in addition to being Oxfam ambassador, Scarlett Johansson was also a representative to much of the real world for the SodaStream product, which is and to this day is still being manufactured in industrial facilities that are inside an illegal Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank, which itself is being illegally occupied militarily for some over 40 years now, since the 1967 war. This is an ongoing and totally unnecessary occupation by the Israeli army, aided by the Air Force and even the Navy to some extent. Certainly not unnecessary as far as many Israelis are concerned, because they continue to erect, against international law, these settlements, which are for Jews only, Israeli Jews only, in the occupied territories. This, of course, is the real reason why Israel continues to occupy these areas. They don't give a damn about the well-being of the native Palestinians who are there. Indeed, Israel makes these sometimes bizarre and absurd excuses for cleansing the land of non-Jewish residents, saying things like the Arabs have no historical validity to claiming the land whatsoever, and on and on. Now, Hollywood actor or actress, depending on how which word you prefer to use, Scarlett Johansson, has chosen, because of the scandal, the outing of this information of the conflict of interest, she has chosen to vacate her seat as Oxfam ambassador and instead to continue her association with SodaStream. SodaStream, the product itself, is simply a device that takes your tap water, carbonates it, and allows you to flavor it so you have your homemade colas and root beers and on 7-Ups and on and on. Sounds like a good idea, regardless of what some will say about the ethical, health-oriented efficacy of what this stuff does to your dental hygiene. But entirely aside from that, what sounds like an innocent and innocently manufactured product for people in Israel to profit from, is being manufactured and produced on land that was literally stolen from the Palestinians and continues to be withheld from them. And they use minerals, which is to say mainly the land itself and water, a great deal of water, which should go to the Palestinian farmers and families who live there and is largely being deprived to them now. Instead, that water is diverted to the purposes of manufacturing and distributing this SodaStream product. So, Johansson continues her association with the Israeli-born product. And I want to read to you the very latest about that. Something to me personally. Dear friends, here's a great email exchange between a colleague of mine and the chief executive of Oxfam. Very cool. Way to go. Way to go, Marcia. Okay. Now, to do this chronologically, I would need to start with the bottom one. This is a letter from my friend Marcia. I'll only use her first name for now. Personal friend and colleague of mine. January 25th. The subject is Scarlett Johansson and SodaStream. Marcia says, I am a supporting member of Oxfam and have been for many years. I am also a member of Jewish Voice for Peace and the Palestine-Israel Action Committee of Santa Cruz, both strongly critical of Israeli actions regarding settlement building and the occupation. I cannot understand how a spokesperson for Oxfam can be a spokesperson for SodaStream, a company that exploits Palestinians whose product is made in illegal settlements. Please explain. Thank you, Marcia. a little more information about Oxfam here. Oxfam works with others to overcome poverty and suffering. Oxfam Great Britain, which I assume is, Oxfam Great Britain is a member of Oxfam International and a company limited by guarantee registered in England. Registered office, Oxfam House, John Smith Drive, Cowley, Oxford. Registered charity in England, Wales, and Scotland. Okay, that was Marcia's letter to Oxfam. Response she received 5 days later on the 30th. From Mark Goldring, Oxfam.org, UK. To Marcia Heath, dear Marcia, Oxfam has accepted Scarlett Johansson's decision to step down after 8 years as a global ambassador, and we are grateful for her many contributions. While Oxfam respects the independence of our ambassadors, Ms. Johansson's role promoting the company SodaStream is incompatible with her role as an Oxfam global ambassador. Oxfam believes that businesses such as SodaStream that operate in settlements further the ongoing poverty and denial of rights of the Palestinian communities that we work to support. Oxfam is opposed to all trade from Israeli settlements. I'll read that again. Oxfam is opposed to all trade from Israeli settlements, which are illegal under international law. Ms. Johansson has worked with Oxfam since 2005. And in 2007 became a global ambassador, helping to highlight the impact of natural disasters and raise funds to save lives and fight poverty. Best wishes, Mark, chief executive of that division of Oxfam. So apparently when Marcia wrote her letter to Oxfam, apparently, this was before she learned of Johansson being dropped from Oxfam. And, of course, Mr. Goldring, in a matter of a few days, related to my friend here, Marcia, that not to worry, Ms. Scarlett is no longer with Oxfam. But, as I said, Johansson continues her association with the product and, by extension, with those illegal Israeli settlements. And and I guess that's all I have on that today. But it was pointed out by another comrade and colleague of mine that apparently Scarlett Johansson has chosen money over justice by doing that, by associating herself with the with this blatantly illegal product, exploitive product. A product which is highly exemplary of the way Israel operates and relates to and deals with its native Arab residents, including those under occupation. So Johansson continues her association with SodaStream, and even though she is, in other words, she gets some kind of payment for this. I don't know if Oxfam was paying her for her work in association with them, but I think Oxfam was far more associative with social justice and those kinds of issues around the world. Okay. I'm going to play for you the soundtrack of a video. It's a couple of minutes long. It's had 2,991 views, according to information I have so far on it. More apartheid adventure videos at YouTube. Remember that phrase, apartheid adventure videos. Let's hear what this one has to say.
Some people insist there is apartheid in Israel. Some people insist there is no apartheid in Israel. We say, what are you trying to put us out of business? Of course there's apartheid in Israel. That's why we love it.
And while the video is freezing there for some unknown reason, I'll just point out that on the screen you say see the colorful logo of obviously made up enterprise called Apartheid Adventures. Apartheid Adventures, like a kind of Club Med for Israel. Let's see if we can get this sucker to go again.
Here. When you go to Israel, if you're of the correct ethnic religious category, you're special. More than 50 laws discriminate in your favor. At Apartheid Adventures, we call this your apartheid advantage. Go anywhere while others stand in line. Build a house anywhere. Can they? Of course not. Walk into their houses and take them over. Towns where only you and your ethnic religious group are allowed to live. Roads where only you and your ethnic religious group are allowed to drive. Schools where students of your ethnic religious group get three times the funding of anyone else. Apartheid is defined as institutionalized discrimination, or any system or practice that separates people according to race, caste, etc., or an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over any other racial group or groups and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. And Israel's got them all, waiting for you. Separation? Get serious. Even though this is not a wall, it's mainly an electrified fence. Discrimination? 50 laws that discriminate in favor of you, if you're of the correct ethnic religious category. Maintaining the regime, we're on it. Israel has the fourth strongest army in the world and has 11,000 of those who are not in the correct ethnic religious category in prison, including hundreds of children, because remember, those children deserved it. Our soldiers in the West Bank are making new arrests daily, and in fact, even when there's no threat or nothing going on, our soldiers make mock arrests anyway, just to keep in practice. We're not making this up. When you're in Israel, if you're of the correct ethnic religious category, your ethnic privilege is legally guaranteed, and we can back that up. Israel, where apartheid is not just a good idea, it's the law.
And again, behind the colorful music is the colorful logo for Apartheid Adventures, a not-so-imaginary rendition of what's going on over there. Like the man said, we are not making this up. Everything that you heard on that satirical, spoof-filled minute or so of video is true, including the part about the dozens, many dozens of laws that are now on Israeli books sanctioning discrimination against non-Jewish citizens of Israel, and certainly against Palestinian Arabs under occupation outside of Israel proper. Even within Israel, this is has been democracy, particularly as of late, has been under attack by the government itself, by the institutions of Israel, and it is moving over steadily from being an Israeli democracy to an Israeli ethnocracy. The word is ethnocracy, and if I may be so bold, it has even been used. No bitterness or anti-Semitism here, only accuracy. It can be labeled as a Judocracy, folks. Okay. Yeah, that was passed along to me by a friend. For more, apartheidadventures.com. Apartheid in Israel? Just go to YouTube and enter Apartheid Adventures. And for those who still have trouble spelling the originally Afrikaans word, apartheid, A-P-A-R-T, just like apart, H-E-I-D, apartheidadventures.com. And that's what that is. Since we're in such a jovial mood, I'll go ahead and pass this along to you. This was forwarded to me by one of my Shipmates in the 2008 summer voyage from the island of Cyprus to the Gaza Strip. Seven cardinal rules for life. We'll take a little bit of breather here and let these seven cardinal rules for life percolate. One, make peace with your past so it won't disturb your present. Number two, what other people think of you is none of your business. Seven cardinal rules for life. Number three, time heals almost everything. Give it time. Four, no one is in charge of your happiness except you. Five, don't compare your life to others. And don't judge them. You have no idea what their journey is all about. Six, stop thinking too much. It's all right not to know the answers. They will come to you when you least expect it. And seven, smile. You don't own all the problems in the world. All right, these little snippets and proverb toids, as it were, they come to you in many forms. This is, they're a dime a dozen. I don't want to cheapen the value of the wisdom in these things. But yeah, we've heard some of these before on different lists and included on different top 10 lists and things like that. And I don't even necessarily agree with all the ones that I read to you. But that is a strictly personal matter. I just thought maybe we can take this couple of minutes here to step away from ourselves, temporarily vacate our heads and our brains, and just appreciate the wisdom of those words. Seven cardinal rules for life. I suppose you can Google that and see if you come up with the same thing. Here's another writing passed along by my friend Steve. He lives here in California, at least part of the time. He's very much attuned to what's happening in Israel and Palestine, but he wants to share this with us, which doesn't necessarily have to do with Israel and Palestine. Friends, is this the best poem song of the 20th century? Sure, such a question is inherently flawed, but it raises several issues critical to progressive thinking, organizing, and education. Please send me your picks of supremely significant poetry / song. I'm trying to put together a small booklet, which could become a sort of YouTube concert of the best world poetry. Of the best world poetry for a high school English class. My criteria for, quote, best roughly include creative originality of phrasing and images with strong ethical focus on social justice and injustice and delight in living. Read the poem aloud and see if you aren't touched in some moments by Bob Dylan's intuitive artistic brilliance with cultural myths and power dynamics in his words and music. Copyright 1965. So this is one of his earliest works. See if you can guess the title or if you know the title. I think I know what it is. Oh, okay. Before I give you the title, I will repeat the fact that it's performed and probably written by Bob Dylan himself. Here it is. They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row. Cinderella, she seems so easy. It takes one to know one, she smiles, and puts her hands in her back pockets, Betty Davis style. And in comes Romeo. He's moaning, "You belong to me, I believe." And someone says, "You're in the wrong place, my friend. You better leave." And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go is Cinderella sweeping up on Desolation Row. Now the moon is almost hidden. The stars are beginning to hide. The fortune-telling lady has even taken all her things inside. All except for Cain and Abel and the hunchback of Notre Dame, everybody's making love or else expecting rain. And the Good Samaritan, he's dressing. He's getting ready for the show. He's going to the carnival tonight on Desolation Row. Now Ophelia, she's neath the window. For her, I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid. To her, death is quite romantic. She wears an iron vest. Her profession's her religion. Her sin is her lifelessness. And though her eyes are fixed upon Noah's great rainbow, she spends her time peeking into Desolation Row. Einstein disguised as Robin Hood with his memories in a trunk. Passed this way an hour ago with his friend, a jealous monk. He looked so immaculately frightful as he bummed a cigarette. Then he went off sniffing drain pipes and reciting the alphabet. Now you'd not think to look at him, but he was famous long ago for playing the electric violin on Desolation Row. Dr. Filth, he keeps his world inside of a leather cup, but all his sexless patients, they're trying to blow it up. Now his nurse, some local loser, she's in charge of the cyanide hole, and she also keeps the cards that read, "Have mercy on his soul." They all play on penny whistles. You can hear them blow if you lean your head out far enough from Desolation Row. Across the street, they've nailed the curtains. They're getting ready for the feast. The Phantom of the Opera, a perfect image of a priest. They're spoon-feeding Casanova to get him to feel more assured. Then they'll kill him with self-confidence after poisoning him with words. And the Phantom's shouting to skinny girls, "Get out of here if you don't know. Casanova is just being punished for going to Desolation Row." Now at midnight, all the agents and the superhuman crew come out and round up everyone that knows more than they do. Then they bring them to the factory where the heart attack machine is strapped across their shoulders, and then the kerosene is brought down from the castles by insurance men who go check to see that nobody is escaping to Desolation Row. Praise be to Nero's Neptune, the Titanic sails at dawn, and everybody's shouting, "Which side are you on?" And Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot fighting in the captain's tower while Calypso singers laugh at them and fishermen hold flowers between the windows of the sea where lovely mermaids flow and nobody has to think too much about Desolation Row. Yes, I received your letter yesterday about the time the doorknob broke. When you asked how I was doing, was that some kind of joke? All these people that you mentioned, yes, I know them. They're quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name. Right now, I can't read too good. Don't send me no more letters. No, not unless you mail them from Desolation Row. Copyright 1965 by Warner Brothers Incorporated. Renewed 1993 by Special Writer Music. And yes, it is entitled Desolation Row by Bob Dylan. And if you didn't care for how my voice morphed into an oh-so-eloquent impersonation of Dylan singing, that's tough. I like to do that. I've heard the name of the song, but I don't even know if I've ever even heard the sing-songy version of it, the recording. That's quite a few words. I mean, I know that Dylan can really let loose with the old lyrics when he composes a new song. This is a lot of lyrics in this song. That's what I'll say about it. I suppose I could come up with more impressions of what it all means. Again, it's copyrighted first in 65, so I think that says something about his early years when he was still doing his Subterranean Homesick Blues and I Want You and all that stuff that were had titles of the songs that either said nothing nothing coherent to you or had nothing or little to do with the with what he was singing about, but that's Desolation Row. So, my friend Steve goes on to say here, after the libretto was revealed, Desolation Row is by a white heterosexual, and then parenthetically, Jewish identified, U.S. American male who cut his musical and poetic teeth, on African-American and Southern white folk and working-class musics, so that puts a multiple layering of ethnic, linguistic, and political limits on it. The same can be said for any single poet who is informed by her or his membership in specific cultural, sexual, and political frames. My friend Steve, the truly articulate scholar that he is. Even so, he continues to say here, even so, in human terms, in our multicultural, classist, racist, sexist world, Bob Dylan could still have crafted as a solo performance artist and musician the best single lyrical slash dramatic slash musical poem of the last century. Surely the poetry of oppressed persons may ultimately be greater than anybody's, but, and I quote, being currently among an oppressed group, end quote, cannot be the criterion for artistic greatness, as many have been the great artists whose personal lives were quite well off compared with most. And some whose work is truly progressive have been shown to have blind spots and questionable habits or alliances in the political arena. The work of art that moves us, that is aesthetically powerful or compelling, can stress the erotic bodily, focusing on the sensual or sexual arenas of touch, or the perceptible, the concrete, the visible, tangible, and kinesthetic, or stress the intellectual, mental, conceptual, self-referentially, rationally, with clever language games. Don't ask me to repeat that, folks. The fleshy or the abstract, and it can be good to excellent as an example of art within such finite boundaries. But truly great poetry, I believe, think, feel, intuit, combines rich, sensuous, and rich conceptual frames of reference while firing deeply penetrating arrows dead center into the cultural mists that explode on contact with the fleshy minds of an honestly receptive, if a critical audience, inflaming their being with recognition, pain slash ecstasy, and the pleasure of sharing with the living poet an immediate and pulsing passion for justice, and delight to witness the poet's vocalized creative declaration of truths we hunger to have said. It fuses the comic and tragic brilliantly and reminds us that human feeling and action are strongest, fullest, truest when spoken and embraced for and with others. Transcending space and time, naturally, since we read works by dead authors and find the works kick us into greater livingness than otherwise imaginable. But I'm rambling now, so I'll stop. Well, at least he closes his remarks, Steve does, by admitting that he's rambling. Oh, by the way, read more at bobdylan.com/us/song/desolationrow. Row. Okay, and time for me to stop. Almost everything else I get from Steve here has to do with the Middle East. So at least I'm grateful that he is expanding out into other areas. I guess he teaches English. So once again, I think the important thing here is, as he asks of his readers, please send me your picks of supremely significant poetry or song. I'm trying to put together a small booklet which could become a sort of YouTube concert of the best world poetry for a high school English class. My criteria for best roughly include creative originality of phrasing and images with song, ethical focus on social justice and injustice, and delight in living. Okay. I've said what I've said. Israel's... You know, it's a quarter to five. My goodness, it's much later than I thought. It's 4:44, actually, Pacific Standard Time here in California, the West Central Coast of California. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. Click that red oval. And, of course, we're back on the air after being absent for an extended period. For local City of Santa Cruz residents, we are back on the traditional airwaves at 101.3 FM. 24/7, 365.25 days a year. Back on the air, 101.3 FM. My name is Ren. I'm your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American, usually bringing you my opinions and my take on the situation in Palestine, Israel, Canaan, whatever you want to call it. How about... Oh, that's right. We're having another benefit. In fact, it's a benefit slash birthday party. In March, Free Radio Santa Cruz will have been in existence for 19 years. Just imagine what our 20th birthday bash will be like. Birthday in March, although the benefit will be held on Friday, February the 21st. That's in just less than 3 weeks. Benefit on February 21 in town here at the Tannery Arts Bar. In the Tannery Art Colony there, just north of River Street, north of Highway 1 on Highway 9. Starting at 6 p.m. We're still waiting for the final version of the poster and flyer to come out. Just remember, reserve that date, Feb 21, 6 to 10 p.m. at the Art Bar in the Tannery, Santa Cruz, California. There will be a raffle. There will be live music by hopefully more than one band. We're working on getting a DJ, too. You'd think that a radio service, even a pirate service like this one, wouldn't have a lot of difficulty nailing down a DJ. It's just a matter of finalizing things, folks. It's surprisingly low cost to get in, considering that there will also be food available for a price and some kind of beverages, I'm sure, available for a price. It is a benefit for Free Radio. As ever, Free Radio is in constant and consistent need of funds from the community, as this is a strictly local community-oriented program, with benefits reaching out upon the rest of the world, since we can be listened to online, of course. We can be listened to anywhere in the world as an online radio service. So, treat this as a benefit in addition to a good time and birthday bash for Free Radio Santa Cruz, February 21, 6 p.m. at the Tannery's own Art Bar Cafe. Or perhaps Arts Bar Cafe. And if you are not able to make it to that, or am just so strung out and beleaguered over Free Radio's ongoing financial crises, you can just send us a bunch of money, please, right on the envelope. FRSC, as in Free Radio Santa Cruz, just write FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip 95061. I'll say it to you again. Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC, just FRSC is fine to write down on the envelope. P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, C-R-U-Z, CA, C-A for California, zip 95061. That's the donate. That is the address for sending your donation so we can keep ourselves on the air and humming in the community of ideas, in the spirit of progressiveness, passion, and just good times, folks. We can also use a new studio space, by the way, for about $200 cheaper than what we're paying. Wouldn't hurt. Now, use the contact information that's available on our website, freakradio.org. If you can help us along the lines of a new studio, if you have an idea for a show, if you want to be a programmer for Free Radio, go to the website, use those numbers. But I'm going to give you, at long last, he gives it to you, and I apologize for not opening the lines up when I was with Sarah, but it slipped my mind, and she didn't say anything about it. So if you still want to talk about Sarah's work, Stonewalled in Jerusalem, call me here at area code 831-427-3772. Again, the line is open to the studio here. You'll be right on the air. 831-427-3772. And it is 4:50. Now, that really only leaves us 5 minutes. So, I'm not going to start anything new here to read. Just want to emphasize the fact that we do take donations, as our Free Radio's very own bylaws do not permit us to take corporate donations or other sizable dollops from anyone associated with the profit-making commercial world. It's against our laws. That tends heavily to force us into asking our listeners to support your Free Radio service. This is the Mideast Migraine Show. I come to you every Monday at 3 in the afternoon for about 2 hours. And there is the Saturday morning, or weekend edition of Mideast Migraines, 11 a.m. every Saturday. Currently, as an indicator of the difference between the Monday show and the Saturday show, I am using the entire Saturday show to read from books. This particular book that I'm reading from is the one that I mentioned when Sarah was here, Sarah Friedlander, a multimedia artist. The book is entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. I'm reading it. I'm now into part 4, or is it part 5? Maybe I just completed part 4. About roughly a quarter of the way through the book, but you can always go to the archives for the Mideast Migraine Show. And catch up with the readings of the parts that you missed. But I am reading from Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, which is a book written by one Max Blumenthal, an American Jew who was brought up with some religiosity. He attended a Hebrew elementary school when he was very young, still a fairly young man, as in his 30s. Max Blumenthal eventually found his way into Israel, probably with the Birthright program, which allows Jews, young Jews from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada, and perhaps other places, to transportation paid visit to the homeland, as it were, in Israel, while they are making it difficult, if not outright impossible, for Palestinians, former residents, and the children and grandchildren of residents and former Arabic residents of Palestine to get in. They allow the Jews from America to come in and, in their own way, stake their claim to the land of Israel. So this is what was permitted for Mr. Blumenthal to do, and before long he saw the dichotomies, the hypocrisies, and etc. that are involved in Israeli society, and how he was forced to face how very unrepresentative Israel is, and Israeli society is to an extent very unrepresentative of the Judeo ethics, of the ethics of the Jewish religion, according to traditions that he was brought up in. So he, like many other Jews, American Jews and other Jews, and yes, many Israeli Jews, have come to cross terms with, they just invented a term there, in dealing with their society, in dealing with the huge holes in the promise of Zion and how it does not meet with their expectations. Okay, it's 4:55, time for me to say goodbye, actually until Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, but I will commence on the next chapter in Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, and of course I'll see you next Monday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. This is Ren saying so long for now. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. المنى والأمل في مهجتي لك محل يا من بيحس وبتمن يا من بيحس وبتمن ما ترحمون الحبيب ما ترحمون الحبيب ما ترحمون الحبيب ويلكم